The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to the Partially Examined Life's After Show broadcast. It's an exciting one, and there's a lot to talk about, and there are a lot of people here already who I want to introduce. We have a very special guest. Rebecca is joining us. I just got a little bit of a background on Rebecca, but I think it wouldn't do me justice to repeat it. It would be better to hear it from you yourself. Tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. So I am a tutor at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. I wrote a dissertation on Aristotle's De Anima, and I have some published and forthcoming publications on it.
Can you not? An expert, I think we can say.
No. I reject that word fully. I reject it as part of who I am and part of where I teach and where we read these books, and nobody's an expert. I just have read this book a lot.
I'll tell you the truth. I agree with the last part of what you said. Nobody's really an expert. And I've been saying this for a long time. I don't think anybody's an expert on anything. And the older I get, the more I believe that.
I think I'm inclined to mistrust anybody who says they're an expert on something.
That's right. I'm an expert on experts. There are none. Let's get this party started. We're talking about Aristotle's De Anima, correct?
De Anima.
Are we all on board here?
Yes.
A fascinating show, and a show that I found a little bit hard to wrap my mind around, talking about, I think, listening to Aristotle talk about the news for a long time made me almost want to use one, Wes. I had a hard time understanding it. But let's start with a few things.
We may not have done the best job on this one explaining it. So well, it's good we have a quote-unquote non-expert.
I'm not going to blame you guys, but let's start with, I took some notes just to get this conversation started. Imagination cannot be opinion and sensation. That's the first thing I wanted to discuss. Imagination cannot be opinion and sensation. Then what is he saying exactly that it is? And Rebecca, this question is to you as well.
It's to me as well as other people, or it's to me as well as other questions will be?
Well, every question is to you.
Oh, okay.
Every question is to everyone.
You can kind of clarify this for me, and then people can jump in from there.
Okay. Well, I guess, I mean, I would start by saying that for Aristotle, maybe one of the clearer things he says about imagination is that it's a motion that follows from sense perception, but that you can have sense perception and not yet have imagination.
I can't say that I'm less lost.
So, you have dogs.
Yes.
I've heard you talk about your dogs. So, I mean, maybe dogs fall into a middle category. We're not sure. But, for example, Aristotle thinks that some animals have sense perception, but that they don't go further and imagine things, so that they might be able to, say, sense the thing, let's say, just by touch, right? They can feel that there's something cold or warm in front of them. But short of that thing being directly in front of them, they couldn't, say, imagine the warm thing that was once there or that was just there. And that sounds a bit like memory, and of course it's connected to that. But they also couldn't call to mind suddenly, you know, oh, somebody mentioned on the show, when your dog might imagine the other dog that was once in the yard. There are some animals that can't do that. They can only sense directly what's right in front of them.
Okay.
I have a question concerning that. So does Aristotle then have anything to say about, I mean, he seems pretty, for his time, progressive about the fact that, like, souls might not just be a concept relegated to people. Like, you know, animals have souls. But he also says some animals just can only have an animal consciousness, that they only touch things to perceive them. Like, does he get into, I mean, I skimmed my copy of the book after reading the podcast, so I'm not sure, like, does he make any distinction or try to schematize that? Like, oh, maybe there are animal, like, lower souls.
Is this for me as well?
I guess everyone else is.
I mean, I think I actually think that's the best way to approach this text is by sort of asking yourself, okay, where are we and what kind of soul does the being he's talking about right now have? So certainly animals have souls. They have souls capable of sensation. And that means that they already also have nutritive souls. So Aristotle thinks, right, there are perhaps three basic kinds of soul: nutritive, sensitive, and intellectual souls. To be alive means to have a nutritive soul. You can also then add to that a sensitive soul. And then you could add to that an intellectual soul. So the things that have intellectual souls are probably limited to human beings. But then there's the broadest, I mean, there's certainly more in the other two categories. All plants, all animals have souls. The world is animate. For Aristotle, it's filled with animate beings.
Right.
It's interesting how he categorizes these souls and breaks down these souls. And not that it's one kind of soul that's deficient in this or that, it's that there are separate souls. And Wes, would you like to chime in on the question of different souls, if Aristotle is specifically saying there are different categories of soul and some have multiple soul, or is he saying that there's one kind of soul but it can be deficient in this or that?
Well, I think Rebecca explained it very well. I'm not sure you would talk about deficiencies, but I think, you know, as Rebecca was explaining, you could think of these as functions or powers or potentialities that souls have or don't have. So an animal soul will have the nutritive power and the sensitive powers, but it won't have the intellectual powers. So deficiencies in the sense it's lacking a plant soul will be lacking in the sensitive and intellectual powers, you know, if you want to call that.
According to Aristotle, can a creature have more than one soul or being?
No.
One soul.
It's one soul.
One soul. So he actually likens it, right, at one point to the way that the souls, I think of them as nested, one in the other. His analogy is to geometric figures. So that in the quadrilateral, we can divide it up and we see that there are triangles there. So, and then as you grow your figure, you might also see a square within a larger sided figure, but you'd have to break it up to see that. In some ways, the question of soul is what kind of being is this, right? If it's a plant, one of the ways we know that it's a plant is by saying, well, it does these things and it engages in these activities. And the reason why it does that is because it has this kind of soul. So what kinds of beings do we see in the world? We see plants, we see animals, we see human beings, and we see a variety among those. We see different kinds of plants, we see different kinds of animals.
He also talks about the souls being eternal, right? First, there's a discussion about the soul as a whole is a form, and it seemed like there was a rejection of that idea because it didn't need to take a form itself. Am I correct in how I understood that? Because I think Aristotle was saying the soul is an eternal thing, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to turn out to be eternal, although he will think of nous or intellect as something that perhaps can survive the destruction of the body. But in general, the soul is not something that's going to survive the destruction of the body because it's closely tied to the body. It is actually the form. And the organized body is the matter in this sense. So there's a close connection, which scholars sometimes call hylomorphism, where the soul and the body are inseparable and the soul is the form of the body.
This is hylomorphism, is the word for that?
Yeah, it just means matter and form. Hylo, matter, and... Yeah.
Like, for me, that's what I'm more familiar with in Aristotle. And it's like, it seems like this book is kind of his applying that, like he's already formalized, that's his theory to attack things with. It seems like then he just attacks, like, animation of things with that same, because earlier he's talking about what is the thisness of something, and then he's like, well, okay, what about mind? So it just kind of struck me today that maybe it's kind of like, this is his scientific approach, right? And it's not necessarily particular to trying to figure out how a mind works, but this is how he's been trying to figure out how, like, most physical things function.
In De Anima, I couldn't find any point where he talks about the connection of nous, or mind, to the psyche, or soul, that is particular to the human being. Like, he talks about some of the higher faculties, like foresight, that, you know, mark out us, I guess, and that things like plants or dogs don't have. And, you know, we all have souls all the way through, but how nous, how mind, you know, the creative mind that allows you to make things or, you know, design a boat, he doesn't seem to talk about that there. I just wonder if anyone knows, in any other text, does he approach that?
Like a creative aspect is what you're asking.
Yeah.
He talks about the, I think it's called nous poieticos, right, in 3.5. And I'm wondering if that's where you're getting this notion of making, that if the soul makes things, that, which I don't think that's entirely what he means there, or maybe I just...
Yeah, no, I just know De Anima is just fascinating for its discussion of what a soul is. I'm just trying to think out in somewhere in the Aristotle corpus where he talks about how humans specifically have this ability to think, to access the logos or whatever. But you're right, it is pointing way outside the text that's in front of us.
Also, one thing, I mean, I think Nick made this point earlier. In some ways, this is not a treatise on human beings. It's
correct.
Just not. It's a treatise on living things. And what is the difference between living things and non-living things, and among living things, what are the different varieties of living things? And, you know, as I was saying before, there's a whole variety of plants, there's a whole variety of animals. It looks like maybe there's only one kind of living thing that has nous. And he doesn't spend an enormous amount of time in this treatise on it, even though that's where so much of the attention, I think perhaps wrongly, has been given when we read this text.
Hmm. I'm curious about my understanding of this. So what I've tried to map it onto is, I think this is a recurring issue that sort of recurs through metaphysics, and that sort of relationship between the particulars and the forms or the properties that emerge out of the interaction between particulars, or between matter, you know, the matter arising out of matter, if you like. So the way I'm thinking about it is this, that a form is something like how he is trying to capture the fact that individual things combine together to produce wholes that have different properties than their individual parts. So he's saying, so he's trying to attach those kind of emergent properties to a form, and then, so that gives us the soul. The soul is like then all that living thing that happens in virtue of the fact that we're composed of organs that when they're joined together do something. What do? They do the soul. And then if you think of the mind, or this intellectual part of the mind, which he seems to call the form of forms. Now, I was thinking about that. I thought, well, if I was thinking about thoughts, how would I attach thoughts to the body? Well, they're not a chemical process or a biochemical process in the way that the soul is, if I'm taking this modern view of it, in the sense that if light reacts with my nervous system, that's a biochemical reaction, and that's a kind of activity of the body. In the way that he talks about sound, I thought it was quite a modern definition of sound, where there's like this something reacting with the body, and the sound is a product of that reaction. So I'm thinking perhaps this soul is this first order level of emergence that describes the interaction of the parts of the body, and then the thoughts are obviously not a chemical process or a biological process in that sense, but somehow must be a process that is parasitic on that biological process, or in other words, a form of a form. In fact, if my understanding of form is appropriate there, I don't know if it is.
I think thinking of the soul as something that's emergent is going to be a problem, just because the soul is meant to have this causal role, and emergent properties, I think, are generally non-causal.
I don't mean epiphenomenal properties. I mean, like, wetness of water can cause a tissue to be wet. You know,
right.
I don't mind speaking in terms
good.
Of... what I mean is that, like, for example, he thinks of matter as a constituent part of something, right? Rather than physical stuff, he means the parts of it. Is that, that's my understanding. So like the brick of a house is its bricks. But then the house has a form in virtue of not being merely an assemblage of bricks, but being a particular assemblage of bricks in a particular
right.
way. And that, what I think that he means by form there, to my modern mind, is the properties something has in virtue of being the particular assemblage of matter that it has.
I think this is to do with essences as well. Like, is this what you would describe as an essence? Like I had a note on this of, like, he thinks of essence as something that, if that thing loses that, it loses its identity, like, as a house. So it's like the basic fundamental thisness of the thing. So does he think of the soul as the, like, thisness of humans or of animated things, I guess? Is that what you're getting at?
It'd be like a good ad for herbal essence is shampoo. The hair is going to lose its form without its essence. This particular structure that is your hair, the way you
Your hair is going to lose what makes it hair.
Thanks for listening to this after-show preview. The full discussion is an hour and a half long, and as you can see, even though we covered De Anima extensively on the podcast already, this is kind of a different approach in that we brought on a scholar, maybe not an expert, but a scholar in this area, Rebecca Goldner. Thanks so much to her for doing this. But we also have our host Danny Lobel and several other partially examined listeners with various levels of knowledge about the topic. The idea being that if some of the discussion was over your head as we were having it, maybe this kind of forum can serve to clear up some of the confusing details. To hear the whole discussion, you have to become a Partially Examined Life citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com. You can get it from the Free Stuff for Citizens tab under Members. Or better yet, you can quickly configure the Citizens feed, which will beam the full discussion and many others like it straight to your mobile device. Our next planned after show will be on Hegel's Logic. It'll happen sometime in March. Keep an eye out, keep an ear out for when it's happening. You can appear on it if you become a Partially Examined Life citizen. And even if you don't, you can watch it happen live over YouTube. Thanks.